Hello and welcome to the Guelph Politicast. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico. This is what it sounds like in the University Center right now, pretty much all over the University Center. It's under construction, rushed construction, as they are trying to get everything finished before the school year starts. But on to the Politicast. Today I talk to Ofer Bernstein, who is an instructor at the University of Calgary and who recently completed his dissertation on ways to get non-habitual voters to take part in the political process. You may have heard that there's an election coming, and at best only about 3 out of 5 of us usually take part in the voting process. Despite the constant attempts by Elections Canada to get out the vote every 4 years, it's usually only a little over half of us that hear the message. But what about the other half? Why don't they participate in politics more? Maybe it's the way we package the message. Getting out the vote better is the topic of this week's Guelph Politicast. Now, nationally speaking, voter turnout was huge in the 2015 federal election. 66.1% of Canadians voted in that year's writ, which was a 7.6% increase over 2011. But there are a couple of things to note about that increase. The first is that 2011 was the third national election in 6 years. And the second is that 2011 was a so-called change election, as in the majority of voters rallied to vote for a new government rather than reaffirm support for the old one. So will 2019 be a change election? Well, a majority of Canadians polled said that they want a change, but will they vote for change? Could we hope to see an election turnout number that tops the nearly 71% of 1993? Well, not to be cynical, but it's hard to imagine more than 7 out of 10 Canadians voting in any election now. That's how it was in the 1950s through till about the turn of the century, where only 4 out of 15 general elections between 1950 and 2000 saw turnout at less than 70%. In 2000, turnout hit a new low at 61.3%, and in the 5 elections since, turnout has gone below that already low watermark 3 times. Despite the best efforts of political parties, journalists, interest groups, and nonpartisan election organizers, barely 60% of us ever seem to go to the polls. So something isn't working. It seems like a great idea to get some academic insight, and into this picture comes Ofer Bernstein. His dissertation at the U of Calgary was called Preaching to the Choir: Models of Citizenship and Concepts of Democracy in Reception of Get Out the Vote Posters. In other words, and put much more simply, Bernstein studied why more people don't vote despite all the effort put into advertisements that tell them to vote. His answer in a nutshell is that people, when told that they have to vote, read that as a little bit condescending. The following is from a piece that Bernstein wrote about his research for The Conversation. Quote, "Instead of arguing that voting is a moral act or a manifestation of a civic duty, we should encourage non-voters to think independently about their personal benefits and motivations of participating in elections and to come up with their own reasons for wanting to vote." End quote. So this week on the Guelph Politicast, I talked to Ofer Bernstein about his research into how to get more people engaged in politics and where get out the vote efforts go wrong. We'll talk about the categories people fall into in terms of their participation in politics and how some of the usual demographic considerations don't apply. We'll discuss why you can't encourage voter behavior in the same way you pitch people on other activities and why the language we use in these campaigns can be tricky. And Bernstein also talks about the importance of localizing the message, making it about more than just voting, and why get out the vote efforts have to have more long-term thinking than just the immediate election. So I caught up with Ofer Bernstein last week by phone from his home in Calgary. Ofer Bernstein, thank you so much for joining me today.
Hello and good morning.
I wanted to start just by, you know, how did you, you know, come to this topic? How did this become the preoccupation for your research? And you know, how did your fascination with how we get people who don't vote to vote, how did that begin?
Well, it's it was a long personal development process. My preliminary and I would say more basic interest has always been in visual communication. And what I was trying to do is when I applied for a PhD program, I wanted to do a study on visual political symbolism. And from that, through the process of developing the research proposal and building a committee and everything like that, it sort of shaped itself into a project where I look into the reception of Go Vote posters, Get Out the Vote nonpartisan posters.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, so it started out more in an attempt to explore the visual perception and the visual reception of posters. And as the project, so I started doing interviews, and as the project developed, it became more and more clear that while there could be psychological or visual culture explanations to the understanding of certain symbols, in particular within posters, the grander perception and the grander understanding of the posters and their meanings to my participant interviewees was informed by or could be better explained with political sciences theory.
Right.
So, yeah. But my background has always been with political communication, visual political communication. My master's has been about visual political communication. My undergrads are in political sciences. So it wasn't too hard for me to sort of find my way in that literature.
Right. When you talk about visual communications and doing your master's in that, a lot of that had to do with political cartoons. Just, you know, I'm just going by what little I was able to Google on you. But, I mean, that was also an area of interest for you, was political cartoons in Europe and North America.
In Europe, Israel, North America, yeah. My master's is about the representations of politicians in American mainstream comics.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, I should say, it was quantitative. It was statistics, content analysis. It was not the common type of comic scholarship you usually see.
Right. Okay.
So it was about comic books, but it was informed by political sciences theories and political sciences methods.
All right. Well, fair enough. Obviously, we're here to talk about how we get people who don't ordinarily vote to vote, which was, you know, what your PhD thesis was about. Having read the summary of that thesis, maybe to start off with, what you, I think you were kind of getting at, and you can correct me if I'm phrasing this wrong, but that we can't apply sort of the political theory and, you know, in terms of how people think about politics in the same way that you would try to appeal to people to vote. These are kind of two separate things, like what people think about politics and trying to get them to vote and participate in politics are almost, although they're connected, they're almost two separate things in terms of how you appeal to people.
Yeah, I will agree with your summary. it's a good way to put my message out there.
Okay.
The way voting had been studied and explained in political sciences is a philosophical way, and it relies on certain understandings about the various aspects of political participation and voting in particular. However, when that's supposed to be translated into the rhetoric or the visual appeal of how to convey messages of voting to people, people do not think in these theoretical terms. So some translation has to occur. And too often, it appears the message is lost in translation.
Right.
So when we look at communication theories, there's a gap there. Communication practices do not know how to handle or apply the knowledge from within political sciences about understanding what voting is and elections are and political participation is.
Mm-hmm.
And this is sort of where I was trying to get at. So it's not entirely dumping everything.
Right.
It is understanding that it informs us in a certain way, but it cannot be applied straightforward.
Right. What it sounds like is that you have three people in the room, one person speaks one language,
one person speaks another language, and then the third person is able to speak both the languages, and the conversation happens that way. There's a, you know, that there has to be sort of like a translator function.
It's one way to look at it.
Mm-hmm.
I would say there are actually, with your analogy, four people.
Okay.
Because there's the person who speaks in one language, the person who speaks in the other language, the translator between them, and the one person they're all trying to talk to.
Okay.
So the main ingredient or the main emphasis of my work is not what we intended to say.
Mm-hmm.
And what do we want to say. My main goal is to think from the point of view of the layperson.
Mm-hmm.
I always go with explaining it as, I'm not here sitting in my office on my chair and musing about what I think about politics.
Right.
My work is going out to the street, get 10 random people, and talk to them about that. Sort of like Socrates did, in a sense, only I'm trying not to be scolded to death.
Right. you managed to come up with sort of like five, let's call them directions, in terms of how we can sort of better get people to get out the vote. And I want to kind of walk through them one at a time. The first one you have is to create sort of localized content. And what I take from that is that one size doesn't fit all with get out the vote campaigns. That, you know, you kind of have to tailor it to each audience. So does that mean like, go ahead. Okay. what I'm just thinking, does that mean like there are regional differences too? Like maybe how you would do a get out the vote campaign in where I am in southwestern Ontario would be different from where you are in Calgary? Or does that mean like maybe we have to tailor one message to young people and another message to seniors who may not get active, or, you know, how does that break down?
Okay. I will start with something very basic.
Okay.
My recommendations apply to a very specific group.
Okay.
Right? So
yeah.
The grander question I was asking, if you wish, a preliminary question is sort of who votes and who doesn't vote, and what are their motivations to talk about or to think about for political participation.
Mm-hmm.
And then by identifying four archetypes of people behaviors or
right.
people's disposition towards political participation. And within that, I've identified one group, the non-habitual voters, as a very large group of people who sometimes vote and sometimes don't vote,
mm-hmm.
and are easier to convince to vote on the more habitual terms,
mm-hmm.
than it is to ideological abstainers or politically apathetic people.
Right.
Right. So I've sort of put I've tried to put the light on that particular group, and then what can we do to get that one particular group to be more engaged,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
In terms of communication strategy.
Mm-hmm.
And through that came a bunch of understandings. The first of them is the one you just pointed out.
Yeah.
And that's about tailored, you call it tailored message or tailored campaigning. The more important point, in my opinion, is the regional.
Right. Okay. Issue,
right. So you talked about, are you talking about tailoring it regionally or tailoring it demographically? Well, here's the thing. What I found is that with the non-habitual voters group,
mm-hmm.
it is less about their demographic group,
mm-hmm.
and more about their geographic appeal.
Okay.
And in that sense, so it depends on the level of election in question. So if we are talking about federal Canadian elections, I would say find a way to run a federal campaign or run a provincial campaign,
mm-hmm.
not to import something from the U.S.
Okay.
Not to import something from the U.K. or Australia, right?
Mm-hmm.
Definitely not Australia, because their system is so different and it's obligatory. So really can't be applied.
Right.
When you're looking at provincial elections, the differences between Thunder Bay and Guelph, where you're at, mm-hmm. are too big to generalize. So, in a sense, it might be wiser to just to concentrate regionally within the province.
Right.
Now, there might be a case where the differences between Windsor and Kitchener won't be big, or Mississauga and Hamilton won't be big. It could be the case.
Right.
Definitely. So, on a provincial level, you might generalize a little bit. You have a little bit more leeway at moving things around in terms of content. But when it gets to municipal level, you cannot do that again. So if okay. you had a very successful campaign in Hamilton, it probably won't work the same way in Windsor.
Right. Interesting.
Right?
Yeah.
So, or the things that matter to people from... people from the suburbs of Toronto and the GTA may not be relevant to people in the suburbs of Ottawa, for example.
Right.
Okay?
Yeah.
And that's, again, that's more about the geographical. So that goes to the question of hot-button issues. So there are things that matter to people in a certain region, and... what I'm trying to propose is that we think how to appeal to the practical values of political engagement for these non-habitual voters.
Mm-hmm.
And so hot-button issues in a given area are likelier to appeal to them than general calls that try to appeal to everybody.
It seems too like maybe it's a matter of authenticity. Like, you know, if it's coming from, you know, people in your area, then, you know, maybe that has more of an appeal than if it's just like a generic message. Because I think one of the things you mentioned specifically in the conversation piece you wrote is like something like Rock the Vote, which does have, you know, is something that's like so ubiquitous. It's from the United States, and there's definitely a feeling of inauthenticity to it because it's... It's something that's sort of been around for a while. It's, you know, it's from the United States. It's a bunch of like rock musicians, and something like that doesn't feel as authentic as maybe something that's generated locally.
Well, I would say there are two different things here. First, mm-hmm. there's Rock the Vote Canada,
mm-hmm.
and Rock the Vote Canada uses Canadian figures and definitely appeals to Canadians more than materials or content that comes from the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
With that in mind, I'm not sure I have issues with the word authenticity.
Okay.
Because it is not really something we can properly define.
Mm.
I would say the messages I was getting from participants in my research is that the imported content is considered insincere.
Mm.
There's something there is just off. We
right.
just trust it. Or something there is off in the sense that it doesn't apply the proper visual conventions to what we are thinking. So I'll give you an example. One of the posters I used, which was designed by somebody from Dallas, Texas, right?
Mm-hmm.
Has a banner, sort of a banner shape in the poster, and it's all painted orange.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the U.S., orange is a neutral color,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So for them, it made very much sense. But once this thing is imported to Canada, all of a sudden, my interviewees are telling me this is an NDP poster.
Right.
This is not a nonpartisan poster. So the NDP are trying to sneak behind our guards and convince us without saying we are the NDP.
Right.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one example of what happens when you're trying to import content. Or, for example, importing content from the U.S. that tries to encourage First Nations people to vote.
Mm.
But in the U.S., they're called Indians.
Mm-hmm.
And here they're called First Nations. And there's a lot of contention in Aboriginal communities about which terminology to use and the best way is always to ask somebody how they define themselves. Mm. But as a general call, it is a contested term. There's a problem there,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So these are just two examples off the top of my head to exactly what I mean in that idea of how to use these conventions.
Right. But, I was going to say, to go back to the color scheme, you know, something like that is harder in Canada because, you know, we have so many parties. In fact, I made a little banner for our election coverage for my website, and almost every color in the rainbow is used because you have red for the Liberals, blue for the Conservatives, orange for the NDP. We have a strong Green Party. The People's Party's been using purple. So it's, you know, there's only so many colors.
Well, so what I found in that sense is that there's a spectrum of reds.
Right.
And there is one particular liberal red.
Right.
And other reds are not the liberal red.
Right.
And other blues are not the conservative blue.
Uh-huh.
And the green, I mean, dark green is not the Green Party green.
Right.
Right?
Mm.
So there are ways to work around it and create, or just put all of them together in a way that makes sense. So the bottom line of it is that this is really not a political thing. This is just a random color scheme or
right.
an intended color scheme, but not a politically intended color scheme. So that's one example.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot there. When I wrote that piece at the Conversation, I really tried to sum it down to the five basic things.
Right.
That are very easy to handle takeaways. And I was trying to think both of communication practitioners and lay people at the same time. Because the larger effort in convincing people to vote is not organizations that are trying to convince people to vote. It's other people who care about voting who do that.
Right. Well, getting back to your points, one of the things I do find interesting, I guess because I'm a writer, but is that the importance you put on how the message is phrased and the language used, how non-habitual voters, you know, they don't want to be condescended to, so they don't want to be loaded with a bunch of facts, and how, you know, people don't want to hear negative statements like, if you don't vote, you can't complain. Does this make trying to craft a campaign, and, you know, in terms of your research, does this make this trickier, or is there just like we haven't tapped into the right language yet? Because one of the examples you put of a positive campaign was something from studentvote.ca, which says a million reasons to vote, what's yours, which, you know, is I think checks everything off your list. It's positive. It poses a question. It's not condescending. You know, how tricky is it to get the right language?
Well, it's a question of I'm being asked constantly with any organization I work with.
Mm-hmm.
And I keep on telling them, it is not hard. The words are there. Yes, we haven't found, or people who has been doing it hasn't found the right language because they were not looking for it.
Mm.
So it's a question of changing, shifting our perception and thinking in different modes than it is about, oh, it's so hard to come up with a slogan.
Right.
By the way, the student vote slogan is the best that I found with the corpus of visuals or corpus of media products that I used.
Mm-hmm.
I also have a point saying, well, actually using the word vote is tricky.
Mm.
In the context of student vote, that word worked.
Mm.
But there are other cases where the word vote is exactly that condescending, preaching, demanding word, or so it is processed by the non-habitual voters. So
right.
It's a double-edged sword.
Hmm.
I would say if we can avoid the words vote, elections, count, say, things like that, it probably would work better.
Right.
And it's and that leads me, that's a segue basically to another point I already made in that piece, that it's easier to appeal to people by trying to make them think what they want rather than telling them what we want them to do.
Right.
So could you imagine Western Ontario in 5 years from now? How do you want it to look like? Right.
Mm-hmm.
What are your wishes for the Canadian society in the next decade? Right?
Mm-hmm.
What matters to you?
Mm-hmm.
Which world do you want to leave to your kids? Et cetera, right?
Mm-hmm.
There you go. A bunch of very positive questions that I just shot off the top of my head.
Right.
Each and every one of them could be a potential slogan.
Hmm. But it's almost counterintuitive, too, because, you know, normal sort of advertising considerations are you name the product, and the product in this case is vote. Like, you wouldn't have a McDonald's commercial where you don't talk about hamburgers, or you wouldn't have a car commercial where you don't talk about the car. What you're talking about is, like, we get people out to vote by not using the word vote, and I think that's a tricky concept for us to get our heads around.
Well, because we don't want people to vote, and vote is not a product.
Right.
We want people to be politically engaged.
Mm.
I don't care if they're politically engaged in other ways.
Mm.
There are various ways to get politically engaged. You don't have to vote to be politically engaged.
Mm-hmm.
But chances are, if you're politically engaged, you will vote.
Right.
Right? So vote is a sort of a means to get to a public good that is not like a product.
Right.
And that goes into a general question of, is political marketing more PR or more marketing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Are we selling the politician as a product? Are we selling democracy as a product? Because democracy is a very hard sell.
Yeah.
Very hard sell, right?
Right.
However, if we are looking at it from a perspective of social value, and we're trying to figure out a way to appeal, to make the social value appeal to people, that's why it will work better than trying to say this is a product and let's sell it.
Mm-hmm.
That, by the way, this is a very stark difference between what I'm doing in nonpartisan campaigning and what political campaigners will do.
Right.
With political partisan campaign.
Right.
And then the concept is you have a product, the politician or the party, and you're trying to sell them.
Mm-hmm.
And the qualities of that product is the platform. But in this case, what we're trying to tell them is, hey, there's a category of products you've ignored.
Right.
Would you consider using them?
Right. Yeah.
If you wish. Although I should have a disclaimer on it. What I just said is a very condescending way of thinking of individual voters.
Right.
It is not the case, and if you try doing something like that with non-habitual voters, you will lose them, and you will push them further into saying that they don't want anything to do with it, and that unless something really, really important is on the line, you won't see them at the polling station.
Right.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So we were talking about the very practical things of the do's and don'ts of how to talk to non-habitual voters.
Right.
This entire process is informed by, again, the understanding of how people relate to voting in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And the four archetypes, four political character types that I've identified. And one of the biggest issues with how nonpartisan campaigning is done nowadays is that it does appeal to a large chunk of the population that does vote.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So when voters look at these things, they say, oh, that appeals to me. That works, you know, to convince me. It reinforces what I believe. Henceforth, this is a good campaign.
Right.
But these are the voters. They're already sold on democracy. As hard a sell as it is, they're already using that category of product,
mm-hmm.
if you wish. Again, I would try to say it's not a problem.
No, and that's true. But I mean, the fact of the matter is, and I was thinking about this just from my personal experience, or like I voted in every election since I turned 18. And I'm thinking like, well, you know, kind of why am I sort of driven that way when, you know, there are so many non-habitual voters out there? What makes me different? But we got to that is that I've always been sort of politically engaged, even before I was of voting age. You know, I was watching the news and I was following political stories and looking at political cartoons and things. It starts with engagement, just in general terms of political engagement, getting people to think about issues, thinking about their point of view on issues, and then the rest follows that. The goal is that eventually more people will get to vote, but we're not trying to create that the end game of getting people to vote. You're trying to create more involvement.
Well, yeah. So what you're describing is what we call political socialization.
Mm-hmm.
And it has been proven that the best way to make adult citizens politically engaged is through socialization. And this is why a lot of the programs that are running in school nowadays all over the country and all over the world, basically, are the ones who are trying to socialize school kids into understanding the values of democracy
mm-hmm.
and the philosophical idea writ large, because
mm-hmm.
that would make them interested. Question is, what do we do with the people who are not socialized?
Right.
And they're now, like I said in the conversation piece, it's between the ages 35 and 55, we have the biggest problem. Especially in Canada, we have that problem. A lot of the 35 to 55-year-olds who were not socialized, politically socialized at home, were not politically socialized at school, nor were they at university. And unless they work in a very political place nowadays, then they won't be in the loop of politics and lapse out, at least partly, and become non-habitual voters.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm trying to do is not to go to people like you who've already been socialized.
Right.
I have no reason to go after people who are already engaged.
Again. Right, yeah.
What I'm looking for is a remedy, if you wish, a Band-Aid for the people who currently don't vote, with the assumption that the education system, the school system, will do its best to get the next generations more socialized in a better way so they become more engaged.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And by the way, just to get to the other point you were trying to make, so what is the difference? Will you allow me to ask you two sort of personal questions?
Sure?
Okay.
Yeah.
When I say democracy,
mm-hmm.
do you think more of a system to run a country? So parliament, parties, elections, ministers, cabinet, et cetera, et cetera?
Mm-hmm.
Or are you thinking more of a grand ideal of civic rights and civic duties and freedoms and an attempt to get a better society out there? Which one of the two do you align with better?
I think I probably align with the second one better. But, I mean, I've also had that education. You know, I took those classes in university, so.
Okay. The second question is,
mm-hmm.
if I were to ask you, is voting a duty?
Mm.
Is voting a duty or a right?
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. That is interesting. No, like, I think my immediate reaction would be like, well, it's a right, but I think I do lean more to the idea that it's a duty, but I would also stretch that out to say that I'm a big proponent of, like, first of all, I'm not sure this is exactly true given how many parties and how many people, you know, sort of run for office in Canada, you know, because we're more than a two-party system. But I've often felt that if you genuinely feel that no one on a ballot represents you, then you do have a duty to go to the polling station and hand in a ballot where you don't mark anybody. And then that's kind of like the formal protest. So I guess probably if I, you know, if you, you know, tie my hands to a truck and, you know, make me choose, I probably would go with duty.
Okay, so is voting a duty or is it a responsibility?
That's interesting too. I think,
because you're saying
yeah.
you think somebody, even if you don't have anybody to vote for, you personally believe morally, they're still obliged to go to the polling station and put a blank ballot.
Yeah, I think...
So it's a responsibility?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. See, that fits perfectly with your interest in not only interest in politics,
yeah,
but your personal interest in being active about politics and running a blog and having a podcast and all the engagement around it. And I had a little bit of chance to look around your website, and I noticed that you're not only interested in national politics, but very much in local politics in your own town.
Yeah.
So it very much aligns with the fact that you do things around politics, that you're politically engaged more than the average person who goes to the polling station once every few years.
Right, but part of my goal with Guelph Politico is to try and get people more engaged and to try to, because I don't know if you've found this, but I think people find local politics, there are even more barriers to local politics and being involved in local politics than even national politics. Like, I mention this all the time. Somebody once wrote an email to me and it's like, can the members of the public go to council meetings? And I was kind of taken aback by that because, to me, it's obvious members of the public should go to council meetings, but there is a matter of access or people wondering how they get access. And I'm trying to tear down those barriers too. And not that I'm putting us in the same boat at all, but I mean, I think we're both people interested in tearing down barriers and trying to get people more involved.
Well, absolutely. And I would put both of us, generally speaking, in the same box of archetypes, of political character types that I've identified as what I call the activist.
Okay.
We are actively doing things about politics. Where, however, I would say, me personally, I would be more of closer to the end of that activism spectrum. So I would be more of a liberal in the sense, again, not parties, in the sense of personal values, a more liberal activist. And I would peg you as more of a, what I call a libertarian.
Interesting.
Activist. You're still an activist. But when I say libertarian, do not confuse that with American politics,
right.
Tea Party, gun-toting people.
Right.
Not at all. I'm talking about libertarian in the sense of what motivates you.
Right.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
What is the motivation? Where are the aspirations? And what are the means by which you define yourself?
Right.
And both of us are on, you might call it, the right side of an axis system.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
We are both in agreement that democracy is more about an aspiration to have a better society than it is about a utilitarian way to run a country.
Right.
Okay. The non-habitual voters are nearly exclusively all within the other side, the left side of that axis system, where they perceive democracy to be a way to run a country.
Right.
And their personal motto, even if they don't speak it out loud, is, well, democracy as a system isn't really functioning so well,
mm-hmm.
and I have the right to vote, which means I also have the right to abstain, so why bother?
Right.
Right? And that's the people we're trying to convince. And this is why our conversation with non-habitual voters is so interrupted, gapped, unabridged.
Right.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Because there's a definite schism in the way we see the two most basic elements of political engagement.
Mm-hmm.
What is democracy? And what is our motivation to take part in it?
Mm-hmm.
Well, and that's something that the practical definition, the practical proposals that I'm giving,
mm-hmm.
doesn't really address at all.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the theory that informs the list of recommendations I'm making.
Right. But, you know, we kind of have to know, you know, before we can make an appeal to people to try and get more involved, we sort of have to know what drives them. And I think that's what your research is kind of getting at, that, you know, we have to know, you know, in terms of what works in terms of getting people to get more involved. I guess maybe tapping into a more activist part of the brain of the non-habitual voter, that, you know, there must be something that they do care about, that they do want to be active about, that they do want to engage in. And from there, we can, you know, set them on a course to being more involved.
Absolutely. Precisely that. And this is why open-ended questions create that process.
Mm.
It's exactly, you hit the nail right there. It's just that point. Because right about now, we need to find a way to activate them. Mm-hmm. How do we do that? So we cannot appeal to their morals about the importance of democracy as an ideal because they do not believe democracy is an ideal. What can we do? We can try to convince them. We can try to activate them through the utilitarian aspect of democracy or the realist aspect of democracy, right? The idea that what do you want out of it?
Right.
Right? What do you want? So do you want to see something done better?
Mm-hmm.
Now, how about we go and do that?
Right.
Let me phrase it this way then. Would it be more helpful to have these sort of campaigns, like between elections, so that by the time an election comes around, people are kind of primed to get involved rather than like when the writ is drawn up, we start seeing the ads from Elections Canada saying like, hey, don't forget to vote or however they want to phrase it. But I think it's more helpful, and I'm wondering if you agree, to sort of make this kind of like a full-time thing, that it's not just about the election, it's about a full-time message of getting people involved.
Well, again, you reach right to a point that unfortunately I didn't have room to make in the conversation piece.
Right.
But yes, it's something I talk to the sort of the clientele, the organizations I've been working with. It is telling them that the time to do the nonpartisan campaigning is a year before the election is supposed to be called.
Mm.
If you know that the writ's supposed to be the writ supposed to fall at a certain point in time,
right,
campaign should start, I don't want to say a year or half a year, it depends, it varies on different aspects, but I would say it has to start at least a few months, so say 4 months before. So if we want to have a good nonpartisan campaigning to vote in the federal elections,
mm-hmm.
that campaign should have been in full force in May or in June. And as the elections near, should wither off because as the elections near, the parties and the think tanks or public action groups that have money start running their campaigns and they get it more and more intense as we near the election. And they have way more money, so they overshadow whatever means nonpartisan campaigning will have.
Right.
And second, they're using a different tactic. They're, like we said, they're trying to convince you to do something particular.
Right.
Not something general. They're trying to tell you choose this, not that.
Right.
And you need to be convinced that you want to choose that category in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So it's a preliminary stage, and it's something, it's in my work, it's not in that conversation piece, but it's in my executive summary and it's in a few other places, that definitely nonpartisan campaigning should start earlier.
Mm.
It shouldn't run all the time. We don't want to run it all the time. Because people don't want to be mentioned that they need to take political action all the time. This is not a good thing.
Mm.
People need to get to the want, need to get individually, independently, to develop, to want to be engaged, right?
Right.
And they need to be engaged on their own terms to an extent. So, yes, we want a minimum participation of voting, say, for example, or any other means. It could be a bunch of other means that are not necessarily voting in elections that they could take. But we want them to be engaged. And once we get that wheel rolling, they will get engaged, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it might take time. These campaigns might need persistence, and it definitely, and again, it varies very much between different levels and different scopes. So, for example, we didn't talk at all about voluntary organizations.
Right.
I mean, you're thinking political elections, right?
Yeah.
But what about professional associations?
Huh.
The bar,
right?
Yeah.
The Accountants Association.
Right.
Doctors Association, the MD Association, student unions.
Yeah.
Other unions. I mean, lots of organizations have elections. Co-ops, different various co-ops have elections.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when you get to the voluntary organization, you'll find that voter turnout there is sometimes even worse.
Yeah.
Although, according to theory, there's a lot at stake there.
Yeah.
If you're an accountant and you get an accountant that very much sees the occupation differently than you as the chairman of the bar or the chairman of the guild, then you might have a major change to your professional reality. And yet some of these organizations voted very low rates.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Students, for example, do not understand how influential their union is as a union in the labor term.
Mm-hmm.
when dealing with government or with their university on collective agreements as teaching assistants, right?
Right.
Or research assistants.
Mm-hmm.
And so the things I'm proposing here are applicable to any kind of body that has elections and has a voting problem or an engagement problem,
mm-hmm.
a political engagement problem. And we keep on going to elections, but let me tell you something. So with how, say, for example, the political system runs, with the first past the post majoritarian regional system, you get a lot of people to tell you, well, I'm very much in disagreement with my the rest of my riding, so why bother voting, right?
Right, right.
For example. And you know what? In the realist utilitarian term, they are right. I mean, if you live in a very liberal riding and you're not liberal, then your vote doesn't really matter, or at least it won't until we change into a proportional system, if we ever do. But does that mean that you are blocked from any political participation?
Right.
Well, no. I've spoken with people who live in a riding very much different, where they're the minority for decades. They've been the minority, and a bunch of them are not voting in federal elections or in provincial elections, but are dues-paying members.
Right.
So I'm talking about somebody who's liberal, lives in a very conservative riding, and is a member of the conservative party,
mm-hmm.
although identifying as a liberal. And you ask them, how come? And their answer is, well, I have more influence on who's going to be my representative within the primaries, within the internal elections or the internal process in the conservative party, than I have on whether the conservative candidate or the liberal candidate gets elected.
Right. That's interesting.
Right? And
yeah.
They are very active in the conservative party, but they're not conservative, not really conservative to the point where they would self-identify as conservative.
Mm-hmm.
So, see, you don't have to vote in elections and still be politically active.
Mm-hmm. So, Ofer Bernstein, thank you so much for all your research and all your insights. I think you've given us a lot to think about today. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, and thank you for giving me the chance. And, you know, I'll gladly continue the conversation. If you get any emails and questions, we can follow up on them.
Absolutely.
And once again, that was Ofer Bernstein. You can read his piece on The Conversation at theconversation.com. And you can find his full dissertation on the subject of getting non-habitual voters to the polls at the University of Calgary's website at ucalgary.academia.edu/Ofer Bernstein. That's OferBernstein. And that is it for this edition of the Guelph Politicast. The music for the Guelph Politicast comes from KPM Classics at Sid Dale. You can download the Guelph Politicast on Wednesday from iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify, and you can download it from the host on Podbean at guelphpoliticast.podbean.com. And when you subscribe to the Guelph Politicast channel, you will also get an episode of Open Sources Guelph on Mondays and an episode of End Credits on Fridays. You can get in touch with me by email at adamadonaldson@gmail.com. Reach me through Twitter at adamadonaldson or at Guelph Politico. There is the Guelph Politico Facebook page, and you can find that at facebook.com/politicoGuelph. And of course, if you'd like to help build a locally sourced independent media outlet in the city of Guelph, then do please consider donating to Guelph Politico, and you can find out how at guelphpolitico.ca/donate. And for all the latest local political news, check out guelphpolitico.ca, where there will be a new episode of the Guelph Politicast for you shortly, and no construction noise, hopefully. And until then, see you next time.